Last Word on Today FM.
Now we're joined today for the Culture Club by a man we've met on this programme before. He has a new book called Music and Mayhem, but let's just hear a little of him playing music first, because he's renowned saxophonist and clarinet player. He's played with the likes of Van Morrison, Ronnie Drew, Christy Moore, and perhaps best known for playing with this group, Moving Hearts. You know, Keith Donald, there's probably a generation listening to us who don't know who Moving Hearts were. So just remind people, just why it was you caused such a sensation at the time?
I think because we didn't fit into any category at all when we started out in 1981. We had in our music, Irish traditional music, rock and roll, funk, jazz, folk. Everything was there. And the musicians were handpicked by Donal Lunny and Christy Moore. And they're all pretty good at their jobs.
And it made for a terrific sound and got a tremendous following for the fairly short period you were together.
Yeah, from the word go, when we played, would you believe, Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday nights in the Bagot Inn, and the queue was not only down the street, it was along the next street and down the next alley to get in, and it was packed every Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, every time we played there. And then we started doing bigger gigs, and then we started travelling abroad.
And you were the tour manager as well, weren't you?
No, I was the band manager.
Oh, the band manager.
Yeah, even worse. Christy did it for the first couple of years. And then I, not wanting to do it, did it because nobody else would do it. And it was awful. I mean, very often a band member and a band manager should be in different places, different continents, doing what they do. But I was, in the days before mobile phones, before there was the euro common currency, I was trying to manage a band. Sometime we'd stop at the side of a motorway in France or Germany, and I would have to go into a shop, get the right money in their currency, and start trying to ring newspapers, PR people, hotels, whatever it took, while the band sat outside in the bandwagon. I mean, it was a nightmare.
And I think it's fair to say this was during a period when you were drinking as well.
It's absolutely,
and this is very relevant.
It's absolutely fair to say that. Yes, I had a problem with drink from I stole my first drink aged 11 until I quit in my mid-40s.
Which is a long time ago now. I'd say you're 80 now, isn't it?
I'm 80 now, yeah. I'm 33 years sober, 34 next month. And I have to say to anybody who's listening who has a relative, a friend or themselves who's got a problem with alcoholism, once you quit, life gets better, slowly, but every day.
You were never tempted to go back to it, were you?
I gave it up and went back to it for 11 years.
Ah.
From I was 33 until I was 44. And then I had 2 years of fighting it really hard. And then I got a lot of help and stopped when I was 46.
How important is the help?
The help, I think, is essential. You can't do it on your own. I mean, back in days of yore, back in even up to the 1950s, people thought that drink was not an illness. It was your willpower was deficient in some way. So not only did you have this disease, but you also got blamed for it back then. And I don't think you can do it on your own if you're a fully fledged alcoholic. I think you need help.
And tell us about Music and Mayhem, the book, because that came out of a play you'd done previously, isn't it?
Well, the book came first and then the play and then the book again. When I gave up drink permanently in the early 90s, I had to put something in the place of the pub. So I'd always loved English literature, and I started writing. And it was really just innocent doodling. It wasn't very good. I remember showing something that I'd written to a well-known Irish author, playwright, Dermot Bulger, lovely man. And he looked at it and very gently told me that it didn't cut it. He was very decent about it, but at the same time, he got the message across, you're not there yet. So I kept at it. I kept writing and writing. I've written novels that may never, that probably will never see the light of day. But then I started looking into all my own old diaries, and I've got about 50 years of them. So I can tell you where I was and what I was doing and with whom for every year for the last 50 years. And that started...
Even in the time when you were drinking?
Yes. That started me off thinking about writing a memoir. And when I did the show is a kind of, it's a musical version of the memoir with songs and playing and different instruments, and I sing a bit as well. But it's the same thrust of a story as the memoir is. When I started doing that, some people came up to me after gigs and asked me questions about their loved ones, themselves, how to get help, where to get help, that kind of thing. And I thought, okay, I'm going to persevere with this memoir because it might just help somebody.
And tell us about the cancer, because you've been living with that for 5 years. Is that as hard to live with as alcoholism, or harder?
It's very different. Alcoholism is every day. Cancer, when it's active, is hard work. But in my case, it's not always active. So I got my diagnosis around the same time as COVID started. So around the same time as the first lockdown, which made the first lockdown very interesting because I was told your immune system is not working very well. So don't mingle with people. So I stayed at home and got everything delivered until a vaccine was produced and I could take it and then I could see people again. But during that period, I did a lot of writing and a lot of thinking. I've had 4 good years and 1 bad year with cancer. Last year was pretty tough going. I had chemo for 5 months. And the side effects of chemo can be tough. But I got great, great help from the doctors and nurses in St. James's Hospital, including a nurse who rang me up every time I'd had chemo. She'd ring me up within 3 or 4 days. How are you getting on? What are the side effects? How bad are they? Will I tweak the medication? Will I get the doctors to talk to you? Honestly, the care was colossal, just brilliant.
And you're in good form now, clearly.
I'm in great form, thank you. Yeah, yeah. I'm still at it. They haven't found me out yet.
Let's go to your Culture Club choices and tell us about the first piece of music that you remember buying or having.
Yeah. Our house, my mother had been a piano teacher. My father had been a jazz banjo player in the 1920s, which I always think was a fairly avant-garde thing to do in Belfast. But the records in our house were classical music and jazz. And I like them both, still do. But when I got my first instrument, my father bought me a ukulele. Naturally, I started singing the old standards from the 20s and 30s. So I was kind of leaning into jazz then. And the next instrument they bought me was a recorder. And I, because I had been abused as a child by a headmistress of a school, I just lost myself in these musical instruments. It was my escape. And I went for hours every day into music and got pretty good on the recorder and played jazz on the recorder on BBC Radio, age 10. Now, it was probably naive and pretty awful, but the fact of it still kind of astounds me in a way.
And it gave you the encouragement to keep going, didn't it?
It certainly did. And then the next school bought me a clarinet. And by the age of 15, I was earning quite a lot of money from playing clarinet with jazz bands.
And we have the first track, Louis Armstrong, The Memphis Blues. Tell us about this track.
It's wonderful. Louis Armstrong is one of the most significant musical figures of the 20th century. He came out of the tradition of blues and jazz in New Orleans in the very early part of the 20th century. He was born, I think, 1900. And he kind of brought jazz into the modern era. He had a couple of things going for him as well. The first recordings and the first radio started up when he was in his teens. Up to then, you had to be in the same room as the musicians to hear anything. So those two things played to his advantage. But he was just such a wonderful player and singer. He was the first jazz singer of note.
Let's hear a little bit of the Memphis Blues.
Folks, I've just been down to Memphis town. That's where the people smile on you all the while. Hospitality, they were good to me. I couldn't spend a dime and had the grandest time. I went out to dancing with a Tennessee dear. They had a fella named Handy with a band you should hear. And while the folks gently sway, all them boys begin to play real harmony. I never will forget that tune they call Handy's Memphis Blues. Oh, yes, those blues. They got a trumpet man leading the band, and folks, he sure blows them horn. And when the clarinet second.
Excuse me for falling back on cliche, but that really is a voice like no other, isn't it?
It is. You're absolutely right. And it's also a phrasing that nobody had ever heard before when he started out. His phrasing influenced singers for decades and decades, right up to the present day, really. Because he had a way of breathing and accentuating syllables and words that was new, but people latched onto it. It was a great, great way of communicating.
We asked you for a favourite album. You've given us two. One is a classical album. You've gone for Mozart's Clarinet Concerto. Tell us why.
Okay. When I started with my wonderful Belfast music teacher, clarinet teacher, John Johnson, he started teaching me classical music because he didn't know any other music. And one of the things he taught me to play was Mozart's Clarinet Concerto. And I just loved it, and I loved the challenge of it. I have to tell you this. He encouraged me to go and hear a world-class virtuoso come to Belfast and play it in the Ulster Hall with the Ulster Orchestra. The man's name was Gervais de Paillé, and he was a world-renowned clarinet player. So in the Ulster Hall that night, up the front are all Belfast's glitterati, down the back are all Belfast clarinet students. And I'm sitting in the very back row, and we're in the lovely, slow middle movement, the adagio. When in the distance in the Ulster Hall, I heard doors bang, and then closer. And then the doors beside me burst open, and there was two teddy boys standing there, draped jackets, greasy hair, the whole bit. And one of them says to the other, "Come on, Sammy, a tie to the boxing's not on tonight." Belfast's best getting the better of culture.
And tell us about the other one you've picked, the original Jerry Mulligan Quartet.
Yeah, Jerry Mulligan was an American jazz musician of Irish ancestry, who was part of, in fact, he probably started the Cool School of Jazz on the west coast of America in the late 50s, early 60s. And I was running the jazz club in Trinity College in 1966 when a tall, tanned man with an unusual-looking case walked in the back of the room. And, of course, all the students who are the audience can't see him because he's in the back of the room, but I could. Seconds later, a notice handed up to me, "Jerry Mulligan wants to know if he can play with you." So I said to the students, "Will you put your hands together, please, for Jerry Mulligan?" And they all laughed at me until he walked up onto the stage and joined us. And he played with us for the night. He was in Dublin staying in the Shelburne Hotel trying to find his Irish ancestry. And somebody told him about a jazz gig in a university. So I got to spend the evening with him. He was wonderful.
Let's hear a little bit of the Jerry Mulligan Quartet making Whoopee.
Thank you.
Hooligan Quartet making Whoopee, which is favourite album for our guest today, Keith Donald. And Keith, tell us a little bit about your favourite band or artist. You've nominated somebody called Tubby Hayes.
Tubby Hayes was an English jazz musician. Back in those days, in the 1960s, there was a chart of the top musicians published every year by Melody Maker. And he topped it every year as a tenor sax player. And he also topped it as a flautist, and he also topped it as a vibes player.
Sorry, what's a vibes player?
Vibraphone. You know the long thing that you, it's a percussion instrument, okay. But it's tuned percussion that you play with mallets. So three very different instruments, and he got number one in the UK on all three. And he was renowned around the world as this virtuoso, extraordinary tenor sax player. I heard him twice live, once in Belfast at the Queen's University Jazz Festival and once in Dublin. He was remarkable. And one amazing thing about him is that he had for quite a long while, an Irish guitarist. Louis Stewart played in this band for several years.
Well, with a name like Hayes, he was probably Irish originally as
he
well,
might
anyway.
Have been too, yeah.
Let's hear a little bit of Voodoo.
1, 2, 3,
listening to that and suddenly think, is that a movie soundtrack and Michael Caine will suddenly start bursting in the door in some 1960s movie?
That would suit it perfectly, wouldn't it? Absolutely. Yeah, he was very exciting player. Incredible.
And then just before we take a break, a best gig is something a bit different that you've gone for. You've gone for Rory Gallagher in Limerick.
Okay, I finished a gig in Limerick and I finished it about, 11 o'clock in the evening. And I was walking back to the hotel and there was a door open in a street, and it was the side door of a venue, and I heard music coming out of it. I had never heard the words Rory Gallagher before, but I was intrigued by the sound. I went in through the open door into the side of a venue, and I saw a sight that was just unbelievable. About 1,500 Rory Gallagher fans and Rory on stage in full flight. He was wonderful.
What made him so wonderful?
He was just so good on stage. I mean, I knew Rory. He was a very quiet, measured guy off stage. On stage, he was almost feral, you know. He took his persona changed. He didn't engineer it or anything. It was just the effect that the music and the playing of the music had on him. He was astonishing. Yeah, I was very fond of him.
Yeah, but he was supposed to be a brilliant technical guitarist as well, was he?
He was indeed. He's a wonderful blues player and extremely good technically. Very impressive player.
Let's hear a little bit. It's not from that gig in Limerick, but it is live in the 1970s. Here's a little bit of Rory Gallagher's performing Laundromat.
Well, I don't have a
Rory Gallagher, Laundromat. Keith Donald is with us. You know him from playing the clarinet, the saxophone, from the likes of Moving Hearts. His new book is Music and Mayhem, and it's a really raw memoir of his time in the industry and all of the things that he's been through in life. And actually, just on books, your favourite author is another Northern Irishman, is it?
Yeah, Brian Moore, or some people call him Brian Moore. But he was a friend of a friend of mine. He's a wonderful writer, very undervalued, I think. And I've read everything that he wrote. And really,
for those who are not familiar, what sort of style of fiction is it?
A lot of his fiction has got a semi-religious flavour to it, or religion forms part of the plot of the novel. But his novels were very varied. You might have seen a film called The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn.
Yeah.
That's his book. That was his first award-winning book. Now, there's nothing to do with religion in that book, but it is an absolute wonderful study in the loneliness of a woman who's addicted to alcohol. It's a stunning, sad book.
You also brought another book with you.
I did. It's called Louis Children. It's about American jazz singers and the influence on probably right up to the current time, 100 years of American jazz singers by Louis Armstrong, and how his phrasing and his delivery of a song influenced everybody from Ella Fitzgerald right up to the current times. He was wonderful.
Okay, favourite movie. You gave us a movie from 1961, Paul Newman and Sidney Poitier in Paris Blues.
Yeah. 1961, I was 16. That film got to Belfast when I was 17. I saw it. I didn't know anything about it. I'd never heard of the actors. The actors, by the way, are Paul Newman, Sidney Poitier, Joanne Woodward, and Diane Carroll. Louis Armstrong plays a part in it, and the music was by Duke Ellington. Wonderful film. I didn't know anything about it, except I saw the word blues in the title, so I went to see it, and I brought a classmate from school with me. And she was very disinterested in the film, and I became very interested in the film and not too interested in her. So the following night, I went back on my own to see the film on my own. And I've seen it half a dozen times. I absolutely love it. Because at the age of 17, I didn't know that you could have a life as a jazz musician. I knew I could play jazz, and I knew that I would go to school with a hangover and a wad of money in my hip pocket from playing jazz, but I didn't know that it was a career. And that film showed me that it was, because those two men, Paul Newman and Sidney Poitier, were two American jazz musicians living in Paris and making a living in Paris playing jazz.
We have a scene we can listen to.
Eddie, now what do you think?
It's good, man.
Just good, huh?
No, it's better than bad.
But you don't think it's good enough to show, huh?
I didn't say that.
Well, you said the melody was heavy.
I didn't say that either.
Oh, Eddie, I heard what you said. You said you had to score it for an oboe because the melody was too heavy.
Man, we've been at this too long. We both need some shut-eye.
If you don't like it, why don't you say so?
I said I liked
it. Yeah, I heard the way you said it.
What do you want me to say? It's great. All right, you're Gershwin, you're Ravel and Debussy.
What's wrong with that?
Look, you're Rambo, and you write a piece of music. I listen to it, and that's what it says, Rambo, and all by itself. Now, what more than that do you want? Besides, what's my opinion, man, a court of law?
Well, I don't want an oboe playing that melody. What do you think of that, man?
I think you're tired. You've been up all night.
I'm not going to give that melody to an oboe.
Well, give it to a tuba,
baby.
Because
it's so
bad. Get off my back, Ram. Look, I need sleep, man. I give up my nights. No sleep, no dames, no nothing. I sit here morning after morning arranging your music, eh?
What do you want, a medal?
I ought to walk. I ought to just walk.
Why don't you just walk?
All right.
Speaking your language, so.
Their voices are so distinctive, the two of them, aren't they?
Yeah.
Paul Newman, Sidney Poitier. And the soundtrack was just wonderful as well by Duke Ellington. Wonderful movie.
Favourite play or musical? You've gone for West Side Story.
Yeah. I've played in an awful lot of pit orchestras, and I've played in a huge number of different shows, including the pantomime and Gales of Laughter with the wonderful Maureen Potter. But I also played...
Have had a varied career, haven't you?
I certainly have. I also played in shows like Gypsy and Cabaret with the wonderful Barbara Brennan, and all kinds of shows in Dublin. But Cabaret, the music in Cabaret is just so extraordinary. It's lifting. It's really good for the soul. It's wonderful music.
But West Side Story is the one that we have. And that, we'll just hear a clip from the original Broadway cast recording, Maria, sung by Larry Kurt.
Maria, I've just met a girl named Maria, and suddenly that name will never be the same to me. Maria, I've just kissed a girl named Maria, and suddenly I found how wonderful a song can be. Maria, say it loud, and there's music playing. Say it soft, and it's almost like praying. Maria, I'll never stop saying Maria.
There was a recent Spielberg remake which was pretty faithful to the original. Why do you think this has endured for so many decades?
Everything about it is good. The people who wrote the music, the words and the dance were all at the top of their game. Absolutely brilliant. So I think it will endure, and people do recognise it's a wonderful musical. Can I tell you my favourite pit story?
Please.
I was playing in the pit orchestra for West Side Story in Dublin. And there's a scene at the end where Tony, that's Tony that you've just heard singing, is dying in Maria's arms. And she begins to sing, "There's a place for us." And her voice is breaking with emotion and she's beginning to cry, "Somewhere a place for us." And she stops. And this one night, there's a drunk in the audience who thinks he'll help out. And he starts, "There's somewhere... somewhere," and the band couldn't play for crying.
Television, you've got from a child something that I saw a bit of recently. There's a fascinating documentary series on David Frost's career on Sky at present, and you have That Was the Week That Was from the early 1960s.
He hosted that show. All kinds of other people were on it, including an Irish woman, Millicent Martin, Willie Rushton, all kinds of people. But it was about the news from the past week. Now, I lived in a home in Dublin where a decent newspaper never crossed the threshold, where we didn't listen to the news, we didn't discuss any current affairs. When That Was the Week That Was came on, it sparked my interest in the rest of the world. So it was kind of significant for me.
And then your current choice is Superstore.
Yeah. Superstore is a farce from America. Have you seen it?
No.
Oh, it's wonderful. There's about six series of it. But it is just, I've cried with laughter watching Superstore.
What
it's
is it?
So funny. It all takes place in a gigantic store.
Okay.
Yeah. And the characters in it are very eccentric because, you know, you don't have to be... you don't have to have a PhD to work in a store. So these people are ordinary people and they're very eccentric.
We have a clip from it.
Okay. Today is a very exciting day because Stratus is doing a profile on our store. Yeah. Ooh, yeah.
What's Stratus? Hmm? Only our internal corporate magazine.
Magazine isn't exactly accurate. It's more like misleading propaganda.
No, it's not.
Minimum wage is maximum fun.
It is.
Work It Off, a guide to injuries on the job.
Oh, that is a super fun read.
Oh, there's a jingle writing contest. Bo could enter that. If he won, he could stop dancing for his mom's friends.
It's my responsibility to show the reporter around. So please, let's put our best foot forward, okay? Cheyenne, that means no falling asleep in the bedding department.
I get tired. Glenn, I'm pregnant.
Not today, you're not.
Okay.
And Sal, I'm going to need you to take the creepiness down to about a 2, okay? Garrett, I love those nicknames you come up with for me, but some people might see them as insulting, so why don't you just get them out of your system now?
Glenda, G-Nothing, Glengarry, Glenn Loss, Glenema, Glental Soup, Transglender.
Oh, that's a new one.
Superstar. To finish, a cultural buried treasure. You've mentioned his name earlier. One of the great Irish guitarists, not Rory Gallagher, but the jazz guitarist Louis Stewart.
Yeah, Louis was a good friend of mine. I was gigging with him in 1967 in a band. The following year, he went to London and he got a job playing with Tubby Hayes. And that's just like going from a very average saxophone player to one of the world's greatest saxophone players. Fair play to Louis. If Louis was a golfer, he'd have won a major by now. If he was a tennis pro, he'd have got at least to the Wimbledon final. You know, he was that good. But because of the genre of music he was in and because of his inflexibility, he never put a special effect in the guitar. The guitar was sounded like the guitar was meant to sound all the time with Louis. But he just had such technique and he was a fully formed jazz virtuoso from the moment I met him when he was about 21 or 2.
Let's hear a little bit of The Dolphin. Louis Stewart to finish out the programme. That was The Dolphin. Keith Donald, it has been terrific meeting you and congratulations on your new book, Music and Mayhem, and continued best wishes in battling with the cancer.
Thanks a million, Matt. Enjoyed it.
The Last Word on Today FM.